ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The celebrity chef behind one of the world's most acclaimed restaurants has resigned following multiple allegations of abuse and assault against employees. René Redzepi, founder of Noma, says in a statement, while he has made steps to change the culture over the years, an apology is not enough. The Copenhagen restaurant won...
Another day, another scandal in the hospitality industry. It seems that for many, whether you're front of house or in the kitchen, working in restaurants and cafes can be a nasty business. And it isn't just celebrity chefs and famous fine diners being called out. Those involved in all facets of the food industry too often face overwork, underpayment, bullying in the workplace.
An audit by the Fair Work Ombudsman of 45 businesses found 35 failed to comply with workplace laws.
One of Australia's leading hospitality groups, Merivale, has been accused of fostering a culture which places women at risk, condones drug use by staff and patrons, and fails to adequately address claims of sexual assault.
It's a story familiar to Lucy Ridge. She's a former chef, now a food writer, who's written a book called Fed Up, A Chef's Adventures in Food, Farming and Feminism. And as the title suggests, this book pays particular attention to the patriarchal underpinnings of the food sector's workplace culture.
Yes, it's been traditionally and continually a very male-dominated space. And we romanticise this idea of the angry chef who stays all night at the restaurant and doesn't get enough sleep and has no work-life balance. And it's a really dangerous kind of stereotype to lean into.
But realising that something was off in the kitchen was only the start of Lucy's adventure. Newly detached from the chef's life and determined to forge a more meaningful, hands-on relationship with food and feeding, she got on the blower, sometimes to the bemusement of the farmers and makers on the other end of her call.
I met Lucy during COVID when she called me really unexpectedly and wanted to come to Orange to learn about making cheese.
I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science, and history collide. This week, Fed Up, in search of kinder kitchens. Lucy, there's a weird thing in our relationship with food. It's a thing that's either cooked by mothers or by cranky men in white hats. What's going on there?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. I think what's going on there is the divide between home cooking and then the commercialization of cooking, so the industry rather than the feeding in the home. So when cooking was commercialized in kitchens, it was actually based on a military hierarchy. And a lot of kitchens still are. So it's been traditionally and continually a very male-dominated space.
Tell us about that hierarchy, because I think that's a lot of people go to restaurants and occasionally glimpse into kitchens and wonder what's going on with these people and what's the relationship between them.
Yeah, so, I mean, at the top of the pile, you've got the head chef and they're the one barking orders and, you know, bossing everybody around. And you've got sous chefs who are sort of the 2IC, to put it in public service speak. And then you've got your apprentices and your chef de partie and all the underlings who sort of really are the ones that make everything tick along. But the head chef's the one who gets the accolades and is in charge, I guess, also of the vision and of the menu and what they want the restaurant to be and what they want the food to look like and taste like.
That person does not have to be a man.
It absolutely does not. But most of the time it is. It still is, even now.
What are the consequences of that? I mean, and we'll get to your individual experience and your journey through kitchens in a moment, but broadly, what are the consequences of that male skew in those positions?
Well, especially considering the hierarchy of the kitchen and the male dominance, especially in those positions of power, is I think we've just seen a lot of abuses of that power over time. And kitchens tend to become quite toxic places where people who are really passionate about this industry and all of that are sort of sucked into this culture of having to stay late and work really hard, and we have sort of the myth of the chef genius, and we romanticize this idea of the angry chef who stays all night at the restaurant and doesn't get enough sleep and has no work-life balance. And it's a really dangerous kind of stereotype to lean into.
You always loved food, and you had a dream as a small person of working in a kitchen.
Yeah, I did. I always really loved food and cooking, and I decided pretty early on that I wanted to be a chef. I'd sort of thought about it for a long time, and I'd been very food obsessed for a long time, but when I was about 15 years old, I did a week of work experience in a kitchen, and that was the absolute turning point for me. I just fell in love with the industry. I fell in love with cooking in kitchens and the feeling of, you know, somebody being served the food that you created. It was magic to me.
Well, and significantly too, you began that experience working for a woman.
Yes, yeah, working for a chef named Mary Beth, who over time I would call my chef mama because she taught me everything I knew and raised me up from an apprentice baby. So I definitely had a pretty atypical apprenticeship in that, yeah, I was working for a woman, the kitchen was mostly women, the business was partly owned by Mary Beth and also a couple, a man and a woman, and even when I was an apprentice, all the other chefs would say, oh, this kitchen's not like any others and you'll never work anywhere else like this again. But I think when you're 15 or 16 years old, you don't really understand that. And I just sort of said, yeah, whatever. And I didn't really know what the industry was like outside of that one very special place.
Which you would discover.
Yes.
What were the key, I mean, in that feminized kitchen? What were the sort of the key differences from the other kitchens you would later discover in your career?
I remember a real sense of fun and playfulness, and everyone was very patient as well. There was a real emphasis on teaching and on developing your skills, especially as a young person. There was a time when actually there were several apprentices who were employed by the business working under only sort of one or two fully qualified chefs, but those apprentices were able to sort of step into roles of responsibility and really kind of get a feel for what it was like to, you know, to run the pass or to be in charge of a catering job. And so it was a really positive learning environment and a really positive culture as well. You know, there was no bullying, there was no nastiness, there was just a lot of fun.
Men could do that too, surely.
I mean, yeah, men could do that, but I mean, a lot of them don't.
this is what strikes me. Is there something particular about how the patriarchy operates in kitchens that makes it different to other workplaces? Or is it all part and parcel of the same thing? Or is it there's something particular in the kitchen setting?
I mean, it's part and parcel of the same thing. Kitchens are really sort of high energy places and high adrenaline places. And so I think for that reason, sometimes it feels like a very different atmosphere to other jobs. There's sort of a real kind of almost trauma bonding, you know, like, oh, we all had such a busy service and we got through it. And so there can be a real sense of camaraderie around that. But when that is mismanaged, it can become extremely stressful. And unfortunately, there are a lot of chefs in the industry who then turn to addictive substances to try and replicate that that adrenaline rush outside of work, or to, you know, sort of temper the influences to replicate some highs and some lows and to relax after a big night or pick themselves up.
I mean, it's an absurd generalisation, and this is just in I guess I'm a journalist, and in my working experience as a journalist, I've seen similar things to what you describe of male environments that thrive on brinksmanship and working too hard under too much pressure, and that's sort of a badge of honour.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way we do things here, and if you can't take it, get out.
Yeah, it's certainly not unique to kitchens, I think, but for whatever reason, I think the hospitality industry has perhaps not had the same kind of awakening as a lot of other industries, and it hasn't been subject to the same scrutiny or levels of change that other places have seen.
But that also, in terms of your journey in kitchens, that was a realisation that was accompanied by a really severe burnout. I mean, you were not dealing with this well from a mental health point of view.
No, and I think I'd fallen into a trap, which is certainly not unique to me or to hospitality, but I think is a feeling that a lot of women might relate to, is that feeling that I needed to be the best, I needed to be the person who was indispensable to the business, and that was how I sort of proved my worth. And in doing so, I was working, you know, really long hours, I was, you know, covering extra shifts, I wasn't taking days off, and so it really had burnt me out. And then I wasn't feeling the joy anymore, because I'd lost that creativity and I'd lost that sense of play.
There's an anecdote you give in the book. I wonder if you could describe it for us, of a day into an evening that you spend working while the lads are on the golf course.
Oh yeah, this was still years away from the point of burnout, which I think is interesting to look back on. That there was,
the embers were just beginning to glow.
Yeah, there were a lot of red flags for a long time. So this was a restaurant that had sort of a full day kind of offering. There was brunch, there was evening drinks and snacks, there was a dinner menu. It was sort of close to a hotel, so there was lots of things going on. And I was the brunch chef. You know, that's what I was doing. I was running the kitchen for brunch service, and so there were a few of us, you know, who were really busy all day. If anyone's been to Canberra, you know, brunch in Canberra is a big deal. So, you know, big Saturday brunch crowd. We'd been, you know, just run off our feet for hours and hours. And then at the end of the day, you clean up the kitchen, you write your prep list for the next day, and then you hand over to the evening team. And the evening team wasn't there, and they weren't there, and they still weren't there. And so I was doing their prep, because someone needed to do it. You know, we needed to have enough potato for evening service. We needed to have enough serves of duck to get us through a busy Saturday night. And eventually they all rolled in fresh off the golf course. And then when I sort of confronted them and said, hey, this isn't okay. I've been doing your work. I've been here since like 6 o'clock in the morning, and you've rolled in a few beers deep. And they said, oh, you know, I didn't even think girls liked playing golf. Oh, we'll invite you next time. You know, no understanding of why I might be angry with them.
That's the absolute clincher of that anecdote, that they think it's about golf.
Yes, yes.
Conventional wisdom says that the sort of sexist toxicity of kitchens has changed a little. Do you think that's true?
I go through phases of believing it's true, and then I read the news about, you know, all sorts of exposés about things that have been happening in Sydney and even Noma. And I think broadly speaking, things are improving for a lot of people. I certainly know a lot of people still in the industry who are having a much better experience than I did, and who are committed to making sure other young people have a much better experience when they come up through the ranks. But there are definitely still a few bad apples in the basket.
Lucy Ridge, a former chef, now food writer, and the author of Fed Up, A Chef's Adventures in Food, Farming and Feminism. And from ABC Radio National, you're listening to Every Bite. I'm Jonathan Green. So, burnt out and ticked off, Lucy walked out of commercial kitchens for good. But as a passionate foodie who's seen that life in the food industry can be a wonderful thing, she went in search of the farmers and makers taking a different approach, perhaps a feminist approach to food.
Yeah, so I sort of realised, I was thinking back to what got me started in the industry, and what did I love about food, and how did I feel when I was, you know, 16 and a fresh apprentice and working in kitchens. I wanted to get back to that feeling. And part of it was that I realised that I had a really strong female mentor who was teaching me, and I knew that even though I was unhappy as a chef, I still really loved food. That was still a passion of mine. And so basically I sort of sat down and thought to myself, okay, well, what if, just as the way that week of work experience when I was, you know, 15 years old changed my life, what if I could go and do work experience with other women in food and in the food industry and find out if some of those jobs and those roles are for me in different parts of food? So
you hit the phone.
Yeah, I hit the phone. I started searching. I started, you know, I had spreadsheets, I had lists, I posted in Facebook groups. I scrolled and scrolled and scrolled and scrolled my way through social media trying to...
What were you looking for? What was on those lists?
So I had quite a few things on the list. I wanted to get quite a broad coverage, not only of different sections of the industry, but also different parts of Australia. Because I was coming up with this plan, you know, while I was unemployed on the couch, Centrelink music on hold in, you know, the early part of 2020. And so it felt like we were never going to get to travel the world again. And I thought, okay, well, silver lining, why don't I take this opportunity to see more of Australia? So I was looking for people in different parts of the country, but also women engaged in different parts of the industry. So I was really interested in farming, getting, you know, onto the farm, growing food in paddocks. I was actually really interested in brewing beer, and that was the one that didn't come off. I wasn't able to find someone to take me on.
There's some gin in there, though, isn't there?
But there's gin and there's wine, so definitely, you know, alcohol features and fermenting features, certainly, in quite a few different things. I also really wanted to make sure that I learnt more about Indigenous food and bush foods and Indigenous ways of thinking about foods, because, you know, when I was a chef, using bush foods was becoming quite trendy in kitchens, but it had sort of always felt very transactional to me, and I knew that I didn't have a good enough understanding of the bush foods industry and of Indigenous people's place in that. So I also wanted to learn more about bush foods, and I wanted to make sure that I had something ocean-based as well. You know, Australia is an island. We're surrounded by amazing seafood. So eventually I found an oyster farmer to take me on, which was really exciting as well.
So what you did was cold call people and say, can I come and hang out with you for a bit and watch what you do?
Yeah, essentially. And unsurprisingly, a lot of people said, what? No, thank you.
That's the beer people.
Which, you know, I totally understand, because, you know, I sort of imagine back to when I was a chef, if somebody who'd never worked in the industry said, hey, can I just come and hang out in your kitchen? I don't really know what I'm doing, but I just want to sort of follow you around while you're busy and learn about what you do. I would have been like, no, absolutely not. Go to TAFE, do an apprenticeship. So I definitely contacted a lot more people than those who eventually agreed to take me on. And I'm very grateful to those who did agree to take me on. And they were very generous with their time and with their expertise.
Well, one person actually took you on as an employee, and that's S.J. Pinner from Second Mouse Cheese in Orange in the upper middle of New South Wales. S.J., hello.
Hello, nice to be here.
You're a cheesemaker. Can you recall Lucy's cold call?
I cannot. I have a terrible memory, but I do know that suddenly there was this person who was talking to me and wanted to come to Orange to learn about making cheese. And I remember how much passion she brought to it and how excited she was at this concept. And I guess I didn't feel like I could say no to that kind of love and enthusiasm.
What do you make of Lucy's proposition that there's a fair bit of unhelpful maleness in hospitality and in areas around the food business in this country?
I certainly don't disagree with her. I've never worked in hospitality directly myself, but I grew up and started my career in the mining industry, so I've definitely seen issues with male-dominated workplaces.
So Lucy describes you as a cheesemaker by chance. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, it's a very fair description. I got a one-day learn to make cheese at home course as a birthday present.
Oh,
and that's where it all started. I fell down a rabbit hole and I just became really obsessed, and I started looking for courses, and I eventually found the Artisan Cheesemakers Academy of Australia in Adelaide, and I decided I was going to take some time off my work drawing, you know, boring power line technical drawings, and go and do that. And that was really the first time I'd ever had any exposure to anybody who worked in the food industry. And it was the first time I met people who actually loved what they did. And it was really intoxicating, and to see so much satisfaction in the people who worked in that industry, I knew I wanted to be a part of that. And time went on, and I met the founder of Second Mouse Cheese Co. at a party here locally, and got talking, and was like, oh, I love what you do and I make cheese and blah, blah. And he said, well, you know, I could do with somebody for a couple of days a week. Do you want a job? I went, oh, yeah, fantastic. And I stayed with him for a while, and then eventually I had the opportunity to purchase the business. And I think, like a lot of things, I've just sort of gone like, I think I might do this, and jumped in the deep end, given zero thought to what I was doing, and then just spent a whole bunch of time swimming to the shallow waters.
What did you discover, Lucy, when you turned up at Second Mouse Cheese? What was your impression?
Well, I guess one of my first impressions of the actual facility was that I thought that I was a pretty clean chef, but I didn't know anything about hygiene until I walked into a cheese factory.
Tell me about hand sanitizing.
Oh, hand sanitizer. I mean, SJ still lives this, and I look back on it semi-fondly, you know, always having wet hands or sanitizing your hands after you touch anything. So, you know, you couldn't touch doors or buttons or even just the corner of the bench. You know, you've got to sanitize your hands, because you're really creating a blank canvas for the right bacteria to grow into cheese. And if you start messing up that canvas with other bacteria, then you might end up with sort of a Jackson Pollock-esque mess of things and a lot of bacteria that you may not want in there. So, yeah, it was a totally different way of thinking about being clean.
But you found joy there.
I did, yeah. I really enjoyed it. Cheese making is so hands-on. It's so hands-on that you're literally up to your elbows in it. Like, that was really satisfying and quite a quick turnaround from sort of the raw milk to a cheese that you could, you know, that you could have on a cheese board and eat with crackers. And so that was really satisfying, that sense of creation and making something from nothing.
Is that part of it, SJ, that sense of sort of alchemy in making cheese?
Oh, absolutely. Lucy talked earlier about the magic that she experienced. And for me, it was also magical. You know, you take some milk and you heat it up and you add a little pinch of this and a few drops of that, and suddenly it goes solid and it turns into curd, which turns into cheese. It really is an amazing process. And there is, for the way that we make cheese, I've always tried to bring maybe a sense of, like, not ritual, but practice. You know, our quality comes from consistency. So we're doing the same tasks the same way every day. And that has a bit of a meditative aspect. And I think, you know, and you are dealing with a living product. So the respect for a living product and sort of you're performing these sort of practices over and over, it does have a really magical quality. And it's wonderful to see something, yeah, like Lucy said, be created out of a raw material. And then at the end of the day, there's a cheese there. It's exciting.
SJ, this is part of a broader thing. The thing that Lucy sketches in her book is this patchwork of people like yourself doing stuff with commitment and joy and passion, making beautiful things. But when we put that together into a national picture, it becomes a really interesting community.
Oh, it's a fascinating community. You know, people who just have a strange little love, and they've made it their life's work. And, you know, the people who, you know, we bring into our businesses, we were always looking for people who share that passion and that excitement, because, you know, it's a tough job. It doesn't pay as well as, you know, corporate work. And it's a physical job. But the love for it is intoxicating, and people tend to flock together. And, you know, here in Orange, where we're based, we have a great community of chefs and makers and growers and winemakers and brewers and all that kind of stuff. So it's a whole community here of many people. And, you know, there's a certain shared love that ties everybody together, no matter their differences.
Lucy, how important are those communities and those broader patchworks with sort of healing our relationship with food?
Oh, it's hugely important. And I think part of what also kind of really radicalized me along this process was that I realized that that's actually a much better way of doing things and a much better way of producing food, rather than sort of these big corporate systems of, you know, huge industrial farms and, you know, a supermarket duopoly. And that was what was leading to a lot of my disconnect to where, you know, where that food was coming from when I was a chef. But these small communities of producers are actually doing really important work and deserve to be supported a lot more, not just from the consumer angle, but also from a government angle. You know, all of the food regulations are aimed at big industrial corporate food, and it makes it really hard to operate as a small-scale producer in this country. But I think there is really a path forward for us to support those small-scale producers who then directly support their communities.
And the important part of that support, I guess, is to support things that are small.
Yes.
Is not to condition support around becoming big.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's that myth in Australian agriculture of go big or go home. But I thought it was really important to kind of shine a light on the fact that there is another way of doing things, and it is a successful way of doing things. You know, like all of the women that I worked with are running successful, thriving businesses, you know. It's very possible to do things a different way. And in fact, people do all over the world and have done forever. And it's really a lie that we've been sold that we can only feed the world through industrial agriculture. It's not true. And supermarkets don't care about the community. They just care about their shareholders and the bottom line. But, you know, small farmers markets are community-driven hubs, and they, you know, they link back directly into their communities, and they care about the environment. You know, as a small-scale farmer, you can't be polluting the land and the water around you and then turning up at the farmer's market that weekend to look people in the eye. You know, you have to take care of the environment around you, because that's where your family lives, that's where your friends live, that's where your community lives.
There are men doing this too, of course, but how important was it to you to find this community of women engaged in that kind of project?
Yeah, I mean, yes, men can be farmers too. Men can be butchers too. We'll allow it. But for me, it was just really important to find that sense of mentorship that I'd initially found in kitchens. And for me, I knew that that meant seeking out women, because I think the other part of that, or the other side of the coin, is that when women have been historically excluded from different practices in different areas, or when anyone has been historically excluded from an industry or an area, when they come into that space, they're inherently poised to do things differently, because they're not bogged down in the traditions, or this is the way we've always done things, or this is what happened to me when I was an apprentice, so it's got to happen to you too. And so there's actually research about the fact that women, for example, coming in as first-generation farmers, are farming in different ways. They're farming more in tune with nature. They're listening to Indigenous ways of land management. They're more focused on environmental and community outcomes. And I think that's a really important thing to think about, is that when people have been excluded, they have such a different perspective and such a new way of looking at things.
It's kind of refreshing, isn't it? For all the tales of aggression and abuse in commercial kitchens, here are stories of the simple pleasure of making and producing, of people, or women in this case, lost in the simple wonder of produce and plate. It doesn't undo all the ills of the world, but it's something to be grateful for, perhaps even to seek out. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every Bite tells a story. And thanks to our guests, Lucy Ridge and S.J. Pinner. Lucy's book is out now. It's called Fed Up, A Chef's Adventures in Food, Farming and Feminism. And you can hear Every Bite on ABC Radio National and at any time at all on ABC Listen, or of course, wherever you get your podcasts. Share us round, like a fine piece of produce. That's what we are. We love to hear from you. You can email us at everybite, or one word, at abc.net.au. everybite@abc.net.au. Every Bite, made on Wurundjeri country, produced by Kim Jurek. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.